Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Backcountry Democracy and the Whiskey Insurrection, The Legal Culture and Trials, 1794 to 1795, by Linda Mirsiadis. Narrated by Wendy Tremont King. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to Appendix A, which can be found in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. Hamilton.
Sir, is this about the Whiskey Rebellion?
Washington.
You could have given me a word of warning.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, One Last Ride, Hamilton. Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical, Hamilton, opened on Broadway in 2015 and proceeded to win 8 Drama Critics Awards, 11 Tony Awards, a Pulitzer Prize for Drama, and a Grammy for Best Musical Theater Album. Had the world seen an earlier draft, it would have heard a different version of the song One Last Ride, a late 20th century take on the Whiskey Rebellion. In this variation, George Washington expresses his impatience with Alexander Hamilton when he hears about the rebellion, as if to suggest that it was an event that would have pleased his Secretary of the Treasury, who at the very least could have given me a word of warning. For his part, Hamilton shifts the blame to Thomas Jefferson, whom he depicts as an agitator with an interest in creating discontent, even though Jefferson had already resigned his position of Secretary of State. Still, Hamilton, obsessed with paying the country's war debt, avows, "The whiskey tax is very unpopular, but necessary, sir." Like the Roman general, Cincinnatus, Washington is distracted by his desire to retire to his country estate, preoccupied with memorializing his run as president, and annoyed with the mess James Madison made of the first draft of his farewell address, which is still 2 years away. In response to Washington's wish to teach him how to say goodbye, Hamilton asks, "But what about the rebels, who are mad about this whiskey?" "First," Washington insists, "write my farewell address," playing on Hamilton's reputation as the fixer in his administration, and the fact that Hamilton had been drafting the president's proclamations to the nation throughout the rebellion. Ultimately, Miranda's Washington declares he's ready for one last ride while he's still in his prime. He has a plan to win this thing, but needs Hamilton by his side. Assuming his historical role in accompanying Washington to join the federal army sent to quell the rebellion, Hamilton prods Washington to suit up and flatters him that he was born to lead and can reign as long as you're alive. Washington's false modesty makes him appear a reluctant warrior, as he never wanted a crown, never wanted to lead. But lead he must, as he takes what purports to be his last ride against an outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, outplanned bunch of tax dodgers, shouting, "Pay your fucking taxes!" Hamilton presents his boss as the greatest man in all the land, and cries out, "Please rise for your president." "George Washington," the crowd acclaims, to which Hamilton adds, having stage-managed the whole charade, "History has its eyes on you." Intentionally or not, Miranda touches on central themes in our changing understanding of an event in early American history that served as a stress test for the new country's experiment in democracy, primarily the conflict between Republican and Federalist partisan interests. Hamilton's overweening ambition in pursuing and enforcing a federal excise tax,
and Washington's preoccupation with his reputation and his public image. But it was also a question of who controlled the government's position, the solitary Hamilton or the more collaborative Washington, and why the rebels were constructed not as citizens participating in democracy, but as rabble undermining the development of a nation. More consequentially, it was a test of whether the events of 1794 were merely a question of a tax on whiskey or a struggle between competing visions for the United States: localism and democratic rights, as opposed to centralized power and federal control over the states. Views of the rebellion have continued to shift over time, because historians failed to take on the challenge of dealing seriously with the rebel perspective. To what extent was popular resistance a question of the First Amendment rights of petitioning, assembly, speech, association, and the right to bear arms? How invested were the people in representative democracy and constitutional rule? Who were these rebels? What were their views? And how did they express them? Once one begins to probe popular assemblies and examine popular culture, it becomes clear that their struggle was more than a riot over paying a whiskey tax. It extended to whether frontier settlers' homesteads would be foreclosed and families ejected, as well as to the unavailability of currency and a punishing debt crisis. The government's failure to protect Westerners from Indians, war debt, land speculation, and a lack of public loans, to remove British forts, and to gain access to the Mississippi River, were all part of the rebels' grievances leading to violence and threats of secession from the Union of States. The disrespect for convention that Hamilton displays gives us permission to see the Whiskey Rebellion through different lenses. For the present study, the listener should take away a new perspective that understands the rebel world as the rebels saw it, apart from the framing given them by their powerful opponent, not merely what they revealed about themselves or their view of the federal government, but also what the government revealed about its predispositions and needs in opposing them. What the listener takes away is more than the tale of struggle between participatory democracy and centralized government power. It is the story of a struggle for liberty, transformed into the paranoia and delusion of anarchy, as told by Hamilton and Washington. It is the story of a founding document that enabled continuing revolution as much as it controlled democratic impulses. It is a tale of choice in one's allegiance, turning into a movement for secession that could dissolve a government or undermine the unity of states. What this study offers is a picture of anti-federalist rebels continuing the revolution, and an anti-democratic government having settled into a counter-revolutionary stance. The allegiance demanded of the rebels was no more than the old Blackstonian trade of obedience for protection, except that protection was hardly in evidence for the Western country, whereas Washington's model for governance was uncomfortably close to what he knew, had experience of, and understood: English-style rule. The conditions under which the new government operated were striking. Washington had an intense fear of rebel assemblies, anti-federalist societies, and the worst excesses of the French Revolution. But the same attributes that had won Americans their freedom were inherent in the entities he feared. The assemblies were representative entities and exhibited organizational skills that recalled the committees of correspondence and the self-governance of the Continental Congress. the Democratic-Republican clubs exemplified the principled pragmatism of grounded political theory and debate. And the French Revolution expressed the combination of excessive democracy, localism, and self-organizing military force. Similarly, the justification that colonists had brought with them to America, the legitimate rights of Englishmen, was mimicked by the Whiskey Rebels, whose legitimate rights appeared in the Bills of Rights in the state constitutions and the U.S. Constitution. Whatever the commonalities of the Whiskey Rebellion and the American Revolution, from the perspective of Washington's government, the Revolutionary War was a natural response to unlawful rule, not disobedience or rebellion. Whereas the Whiskey Rebellion was a delusional and deceptive reaction to legitimate government. The Declaration of Independence was regarded as nation-building, not government-destroying, while the petitions, resolutions, and grievances of the Whiskey Rebels were considered perverse and imagined. In the government's reading, the Constitution was intended to discipline democracy, which the Whiskey Rebels countered with constitutional resistance, the mantra under which they fought to regulate government and control its abuse of its citizens' liberties. Thus, in the hands of the new government, the Constitution justified state violence in opposition to popular violence that supported self-governance, personal liberties, and anti-statism. In his address to Congress, Washington himself celebrated citizens who joined the federal army that would tame the rebels, declaiming that they understood the true principles of government and liberty, that they were an army of the Constitution. What the listener takes away from this study, in sum, is a fuller understanding of the importance and the limitations of participatory democracy, by factoring in what has been left out, the role the rebel perspective played in balancing centralized government power in America's first opportunity to face what democracy meant, for all its fears and faults. Rebellion. To understand the role of the rebels, we need first to lay out a picture of the context in which the rebellion festered, and then broke out into violence. From 1791 to 1793, a series of local meetings and county assemblies in the western counties greeted the imposition of the 1791 federal excise tax on whiskey. In addition, inhabitants of Fayette, Washington, Westmoreland, and Allegheny counties attacked tax collectors. Officials were variously kidnapped, tarred and feathered, ridden on a rail, or left tied to a tree in the forest. Liberty poles were mounted, and excise officers hung in effigy. And distillers and officials alike were harassed by bands of disguised figures. The most serious violence, however, broke out in 1794, when U.S. Marshal David Lennox and Inspector of the Survey General John Neville began serving writs on non-compliant distillers. On July 16th through 17th, 1794, two attacks against Neville's house at Bower Hill and a turbulent meeting at Couch's Fort left Neville's home destroyed, and rebel Oliver Miller and rebel militia leader James McFarlane dead. Those involved in the violence demanded the support of their Confederates, which moved events to a new stage in which a radical mob controlled events. An ad hoc assembly of several rebel factions convened at Mingo Creek, July 23rd, to address the mob's demands. That assembly resolved to hold a representative elected assembly at Parkinson's Ferry, August 14th, where delegates from the four western counties could consult on a common course of action. The consensus reached at Mingo Creek was breached by a small group of radicals led by David Bradford, who decided to rob the U.S. Mail, July 26th. The group immediately called local militias to an interim rendezvous at Braddock's Field on August 1st. There, they revealed letters that had been written in opposition to the excise tax and demanded the writers be exiled. The highly charged crowd armed itself and marched on Pittsburgh. With the assistance of moderate rebels, who provisioned the marchers with drink, inhabitants invited the rebels into the city, and the march was transformed into a drunken revel. The 1794 developments effaced ground gained from 1791 to 1793 in meetings it had argued broadly for protection of constitutional liberties, equal treatment within the Union, and redress of the people's economic grievances. With the rebels split, the radical faction now argued for a plan that included armed response and secession. Moderates argued for a more temperate, rights-based approach. The Washington administration objected to the erratic attacks on officials and the political organizing that took place in assemblies, which in Washington and Hamilton's minds appeared to compete with legitimate institutions. Washington convened a conference of his cabinet and top Pennsylvania officials on August 2nd, that questioned whether treason had been committed and the need for a federal militia to quell the rebellion. The prospect of public protests, political resistance, and difficulty in recruiting volunteers for a national army persuaded Washington to appoint a U.S. commission to meet with the rebels in concert with a Pennsylvania commission. In the meantime, moderates in the August 4th Parkinson's Ferry Assembly had successfully generated a common position based on constitutional resistance. This proved to be a turning point for the rebellion and the basis for sending a rebel delegation to confer with the U.S. Commission on August 21st. Negotiations with the Commission appeared to legitimize the political authority of the assemblies, despite the instructions under which the commission operated and the administration's preparations to mount a federal militia. With Washington and Hamilton determined to put an end to the assembly experiment, a subsequent assembly in Brownsville, August 28th, produced some of the most powerful speeches of the rebellion in defense of the Western position. A final U.S. Commission report followed, advising the President on September 24th that it could not fulfill its mission of dictating terms of submission in exchange for an offer of amnesty. Washington then deployed the federal militia, which he met at its staging point in Carlisle on October 4th. Having reviewed the troops and provided orders to its commander, General Henry Lee, he returned to Philadelphia on October 20th. On November 13th, in the dead of night, the federal militia rounded up some 150 rebels, many barefoot or half-naked, prodded them along for 7 miles on muddy roads to Pittsburgh, and housed them in pens and stables. The captured rebels were then turned over for interrogation, and 18 of them were charged by the U.S. District Judge and the U.S. Attorney for Pennsylvania, who had accompanied the army. They were marched over the mountains 300 miles to Philadelphia, none among them leaders of the violence. Together with other rebels gathered in the city, and including rebels who had fled, 24 were indicted for treason by the Eastern Pennsylvania Circuit Court. 10 were tried, 2 were convicted, and subsequently pardoned. Background. Far from occurring in isolation, the tax revolt erupted in concert with significant resistance to the tax in Kentucky, North and South Carolina, and Virginia. Even more widely, it was part of a larger swath of disunion from west to east and from north to south, linking to a deep history of popular regulations of government that ran from the 1760s in North Carolina to the 1780s in Shay's Rebellion in Massachusetts, and resurged in the late 1790s with the Whiskey Rebellion and Fries's Rebellion. One argument has it that the disturbances reflected continued tests of the U.S. government, from the failure in the 1780s of the Continental Congress to the Constitutional Convention of 1787, and thereafter to a contentious ratification process and continuing challenges to the new U.S. Constitution till the end of the century. Instability was hardly new to the state of Pennsylvania, despite the order maintained within the Commonwealth under the Penn proprietorship, which had preserved order and trade with the Indians from 1681 through the 1750s. The struggle for land between speculators, homesteaders, and Indian tribes from the Shawnee and the Delaware Indians to the Six Nations of the Iroquois ensured that Penn's peace would not last. Nor would border conflicts in the 1760s and 1770s involving Maryland to the south, Virginia to the west, and Connecticut to the north bring stability to Pennsylvania. Because large parts of what now constitutes the state were contested, the Commonwealth was contained to east of the Shenandoah River. It would only secure its borders with the end of the American Revolution in 1783 and the Treaty Purchase of 1784, which created 9 new counties. A land purchase in 1792 in the Lake Erie area produced the state's final boundaries and facilitated the prospect of an east-west highway, preparing the state for commerce and the nation for a farther westward push. Then the Whiskey Rebellion broke out. The rebellion would have to be suppressed, and the Indians finally quelled before western Pennsylvania and the federal government would be secure. With expansionist pressures weighing on the national government and local demands for land tearing apart the state, the Whiskey Rebellion was more than a mere nuisance. It was equally apparent that the Washington administration's choice of Pennsylvania for its test case in enforcing the federal whiskey tax had a personal element to it. The president had for decades surveyed and soldiered on the frontier to good effect, leading to a personal investment of 40,000 acres of western land that made him one of the largest landholders in the nation. His holdings also led to disputed land claims and involvement in a high-profile Pennsylvania Supreme Court case, George Washington versus James Scott and others, 1786, against settlers whom he ejected from his land. Ironically, many of those implicated in the case, settlers, jurors, militia officers, justices of the peace, later became involved in the rebellion. Beyond Washington's local affairs, Pennsylvania's geographic centrality and its economic potential made cries for secession from radical leaders among the whiskey rebels a national concern. There was no question that the volatility of the rebellion had put Pennsylvania at the top of Washington's agenda for preserving the Union. The Pennsylvania frontier was thus a crucial test case for a country poised to assert itself as a nation and to seek its own empire. To understand further the nature of this test case, we need to turn to templates that explain the backcountry in terms of several key aspects: legal primitivism, colonialization in a post-colonial context, and the backcountry as a foil for the city. Primitive law establishes a baseline of sorts as a public and customary means of sustaining backcountry community. The conditions of life on the frontier required settlers and tribes alike to maintain communal harmony through local traditions of self-help and cooperation, and retribution and direct redress. There was no required formal code of law, no citizens' rights or protection as a group. Rather, local militias imposed their own form of summary justice by means of posse comitatus, community self-defense call-ups, justifying hostilities as acts of war against an alien culture in their midst. A second frame construes both Indians and settlers as colonized and disparaged minorities. This frame proposes a dichotomy between friends of empire and friends of settlement, where settlers practiced a democratizing localism that elite Eastern Empire builders found destabilizing. In a revealing transitional moment, post-revolutionary Federalists tried to instantiate nationalism and eliminate the leftovers of local self-determination. Settlers were caught in the paradoxical position of subjugating the Indians to claim their land, and yet being subjugated themselves. In this sense, both Indians and settlers were victimized by a process of erasing disobedience by domesticating it. A third integrative frame links frontier primitivism and post-coloniality to rebellion in defining the backcountry. Here, rebellion is a revealing manifestation of resistance to the frontier under erasure, that is, as both marginal and disposable. As primitives, Westerners were represented by the figure of the Hydra, the many-headed monstrous mass which the ruling elite must disperse. The backcountry, back is both beyond coastal authority and a perspective from below, responded by combining to embody a law that denied existing laws and opposed the city and its elites. Here, the power of the militia bound the debtor class and settlers together, despite their dispersal, so that the hue and cry of alarm held the frontier together. As post-colonials, collective resistance constituted backcountry individuation, while reciprocity yielded a form of judicial order. What we find in sum is a distinctive Western sociology with its own identity. Framing allows us to capture the parameters of the backcountry environment and furnishes a floor for the events that would play out in 1794. But it does not excavate beneath the broader picture. It does not locate the particulars of a legal discourse or an ideological position within the subject of rebellion. In this regard, existing studies of the Whiskey Rebellion also prove discouraging. Without examining the positions of the rebel factions, the nature of assembly discourse, the message of agitation propaganda and popular culture, connections to the anti-federalists and rebel trial arguments, studies have concluded that the rebels were hapless, confused, and incoherent, that their leaders were delusional, disorganized, and wavering. Discounting the possibility that it was not a popular movement, but rather a contest over political resources between groups of elites, or a hybrid of backwater violence mixed with a degree of organization, does not do justice to the complexity of the rebellion's vernacular legal culture, however untidy it might be, much less the possibilities inherent in its more formal legal arguments. Nor does conceding the ground to the moral certainty of governmental discourse demonstrate an understanding of the proliferation of perspective.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?